Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcasts, where today we're joined by a digital nomad. Sounds very intriguing. I have no idea what a digital nomad is, but I'm going to find out, I'm sure, today. His name is Rob Cobbold. He is a digital nomad and also the Director of Partnerships at Beach Token, which is a cryptocurrency that we have discussed on the podcast previously. So, hello, Rob. How are you? Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Kenny. Thanks very much for having me.
It's good to be talking to you. And, of course, Kenny as well. How are you, Kenny?
Yep. Very good. All good up in Scotland here, and good to be speaking again, Rob. It seems to be quite a common theme. We're talking to each other quite a lot these days, because obviously I'm involved with Beach as well. But we just thought it'd be good to get you on, and I'm interested as well to hear a bit about your sort of journey in life, because I think at the moment you're in the middle of Crete. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm in the mountains just above Hania, with this sort of staggering, almost like the view's so nice. I won't show it to you because it'll piss you off. but yeah, it's pretty nice. We're in a sort of two villas that have been set up. They're Crete's first co-living space. There's about 10 of us here from all over the world. Mm. And it's sort of like a sort of mini community, I guess.
What, to do with in the digital nomad space or something completely different?
Yeah, exactly. So it's aimed at digital nomads, yeah.
So it's almost like the little, I've heard of these things in Silicon Valley, there's like these little digs you can get, isn't there, like dorms where these sort of young people all go and live together and discuss ideas. Is it kind of a similar thing but in Crete?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, the one thing that everyone shares in common is that they work from different nice locations. Everyone sort of follows the sun. It's like just like African swallows, you know, we fly south.
Nice.
All right. Okay. Well, before we go into digital nomads then, Rob, I think it would be, what we do in this podcast is we like to, it's usually investors and directors and CEOs we've got on, etc. But we take people from all walks of life, and we like to get a bit about their history, their journey in life, where they grew up, you know, where they've been, and you know, everybody's different, and you know, I mean, I'm pretty much never really been out of the country much, apart from a few holidays. But you've obviously seen a bit of the world, so it'd be nice to hear your story. And it's up to you how far you go back. If you want to go back to your childhood, or if you just want to start at school, really, the floor's yours for the next 10 minutes to give us a potted history of Rob.
Right. Well, I don't know if the right place to start feels like when I left school, to be honest, because that's when I feel I never sort of felt that I felt a bit sort of out of joint at school. I think many people do. But it was actually traveling after I left school for 6 months in South America, and I was only 18. And that's when I sort of really started to hit my stride and feel like I don't know. I remember I was traveling with this guy who was like 10 years older than me to the day. He was called Jonas. I remember thinking, God, it's so cool that this guy's like 28, you know, wants to travel with me and I'm only 18. And I basically realized, like, well, you know, you must be all right, Rob. that had a profound effect on me, and I did a lot of growing up. And it was sort of in the middle of that trip that I became really obsessed with this idea about, because of all the interactions that take place when you travel and you move and you meet different people, and the kind of cultural relativity that's playing out all the time, you know, suddenly your assumptions get questioned. And really, people that sort of do well in that fluid environment where people are meeting each other and joining different groups, and is that the people who do well in that environment are, number one, adaptable, and number two, they're nice. They're nice people to be around, and they're generally kind of like social in some way. And this idea kind of like really lodged in my head. And I became really interested in sort of evolutionary philosophy, which basically sort of argues the same thing. That's kind of, if I'm really honest, that's been the central kind of thrust of my life in the past sort of 7-8 years is trying to articulate where we're going as a species and like how we can be good sort of like evolutionary facilitators almost. So I started a sort of blog and podcast called Conscious Evolution. And then kind of off the back of that, got interested in, because there's sort of two aspects to that. You know, there's how can we as individuals, you know, basically be the sort of best example of our species that we can be. But then how also can we design systems and structures and societies in such a way that are conducive to our species ongoing kind of like evolutionary flourishing? Because obviously at the moment, we're not doing a very good job of that. And one of the kind of key core components of that is about money design and how money works. So I studied a lot of monetary systems and sustainable exchange with a guy called Professor Jem Bendel, who became a kind of sort of mentor of mine to a certain extent. And that really opened up this idea of, yeah, how can we design money to have a different effect on the world and on our relationships with each other? This idea that money design was sort of hidden from view. People took money like pounds and dollars as just neutral, this neutral thing that just existed out there. And that, you know, it's not, if something goes wrong, it's not the money's fault. It's the way the money's being spent. But really what this kind of heterodox economics view points to is the idea that actually, no, money's not neutral. It's been designed and it has certain effects. And it makes certain kinds of societies and certain kinds of relations very easy and others very difficult. It makes certain kind of behaviors very easy and others very difficult. And then, you know, from there, that's how I sort of fell into the whole beach thing. And that's when Chris and I connected over that. And that's kind of what's led me to be here.
Yep. So I imagine you've seen quite a few continents in your travels. I mean, what age are you, Rob? I mean, obviously, I've seen you in video before. I'm going to say you're late 20s, early 30s. Would that be fair? Yes.
Yeah, spot on. I'm 30 exactly.
30 exactly. So you must have seen a bit of world. Where's been your best adventure? And there's obviously going to be a worst adventure as well.
I mean, I would say South America is where I've spent the most time and where I most sort of fell in love with the whole continent. I spent over a year in South America across three or four different trips. Just such unbelievably fun people. I feel more like a South American in some ways than an Englishman. I'm very open. I'm very expressive. I'm very like quick to like people. And, you know, like I'm always up for having some fun. I'm not very closed off. I mean, that's a stereotype that British people are closed off, but South Americans are really open, kind of adventurous, explorative and welcoming people. And I think that's something that I really just loved about South America.
What would be your worst then?
I don't know. I think the real secret is the more you travel, you realize that absolutely everywhere is worth visiting. So I don't know. I mean, I've had some hairy moments here and there, but I wouldn't say any sort of entire country I've been to was a bad experience overall.
Yeah. I suppose it must be quite strange, you know, if you rock up in a new country, you're in this co-living space, and you know there's five or six different cultures, probably religions, and you know, it must be quite a strange environment. Or maybe it's a productive environment because everybody's got different perspectives on life. It must be, the first couple of days must be quite weird. Your niche.
Yeah, I suppose like there's sort of, you know, there's so many, you know, the kind of people that are digital nomads have generally done a lot of traveling. So there has been this process of kind of culture equalization. I mean, like the first time you go traveling, you know, you're saddled with all these cultural norms. Like you think like the way things are done in your country is just like the normal way. And when somebody does something another way, you're kind of like really wrong footed by it. But generally the people you find in these spaces have done so much traveling and, you know, often, you know, like particularly that's the great thing about the EU, right? There's been this kind of like values equalization where basically you can meet someone from Romania or Bulgaria or Poland or France or Spain. And, you know, like, okay, there's differences, but there's also like a huge amount of commonly held kind of values as well. So I think like, I think it's more, there's more sort of like quick gelling than you might imagine.
Yeah. And how do you guys actually exist or make a living out there? I mean, is some of these events a bit like almost like a think tank, you know, get your heads together. You need to survive, obviously. I mean, there must be a method in your madness.
Well, but basically everyone's just working from their laptops, you know. So there's a couple of people here, there's a Polish couple who have an animation studio. So you can do that from anywhere. My friend Duncan here, he's a product manager for a sort of mental health and wellness app. My friend Alphonsine, his wife, she's a product manager for a sort of online shopping tech company. So basically everyone's working on something where you just don't need physical space really to do your job.
Well, you just need a laptop and an internet connection effectively.
Exactly, yeah. As long as there's good Wi-Fi, we're there. Good Wi-Fi and sunshine. That's the two key ingredients.
Don't give Mark any ideas, Rob, because he's already bugged off in the UK to Holland.
Yeah, well, I do have an idea. The only problem I have is I need a space to build a virtual, well, not a virtual, but a TV studio. But I'm sure, you know, it could work. I do quite like that idea. I'm intrigued to know how it works. Is it like, just rent a space together, do you, and you'll pile in? How does it work?
Well, the first time I did it, I mean, I'm very new to this whole thing, so I'm not really the best digital nomad spokesperson, but okay. In the summer, my friend Duncan, who'd been doing this for a couple of years now, you know, been to Prague and Berlin and Tenerife, there's a lot of digital nomads, and his wife, Alphonsine, who I mentioned, she's actually owns a house in the south of France, and it's like this big old farmhouse with lots of rooms, and they were like, well, why don't we just set it up as our own co-living space for a couple of months? So he invited all the friends that they'd met on their travels and a few from back home. And it was just, it was all the things that I love about traveling, but without feeling like you're running away from your responsibility. You know, I was working 4 days a week in a fairly like serious sort of think tank job. You know, everyone's, you're more productive, if anything, because you're surrounded by people who are all working hard too, you know. But you're just having an absolute ball. And on the weekend, you're going to the beach, or you're going hiking, or you're swimming in a lake, or you name it.
Sounds good.
And typically, how long would you stay in each location, Rob?
I've stayed for a couple of weeks there, and I've been here for a couple of weeks in Crete. But actually, most of the people here have been here for 3 or 4 months, and sometimes people come for 5 months or something like that.
The cost, I mean, what is the cost like compared to, like, you know, rent here in the UK? For instance, is it a lot cheaper, I assume?
So this, I think the place we're in currently is right at the sort of higher end. To be honest, I didn't realize how expensive it was before I'd like kind of made all my plans. But this is something like, I think if you stay for longer periods of time, it reduces, but I'm here for 2 weeks and it's something like 50 euros a night or something. I mean, it's very nice as well. I've got an unbelievable room. But I think, you know, the lower end, you know, you can stay in places that are more like hostels. They might be like 20 euros a night in Tenerife or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, 50 euros is still pretty reasonable when you see what it is for a pokey hotel in the middle of London. There'll not be much change at 100 quid, probably. So, yeah, I can see why it's attractive. Probably it's too old in life for me, Mark. It's probably more suited to you, Mark, in your early 30s.
Yeah, well, maybe, yeah. It's tempting. I'd have to look into it. But what intrigues me about what you're working on, Rob, you say this sort of money design. I wonder if you can expand on that a little bit. There's someone who I follow on Twitter. You may have seen him. He's called Lawrence Lepard, and his sort of phrase, if you like, or slogan is "Fix the money, fix the world." And he does some very interesting podcasts talking about how money is designed and how really it should be. This is for the benefit of everyone, really. But I wonder what's your sort of, if I was to ask you to give me your definition of money design and what it is that intrigues you about it and how you're working in that space.
It sounds like me and this person you're following would agree on an awful lot. There is this quote from my professor, Jem, who says, money is a social design, which then designs the social. Okay. So the key thing to hold in mind is that it has been designed with certain properties. It's created under certain conditions, and those conditions constrain what money can do and what money can't do. Mm-hmm. So our money, national money, you know, dollars, pounds, euros, is created, and not many people know this, but I can produce a Bank of England bulletin and something similar from the European Central Bank, which confirms it, is actually created by private banks when they make loans. And what that means is that if you, Mark, go and take out a loan of £100,000 because you want to buy a house, and you know they check your earnings and they make sure you're good for it and they create the money, they create it out of thin air and deposit it in your account. And then you then owe them £100,000 plus the interest. But the trouble is that the interest to cover that loan was never created, because 97% of our money is created in this way. That means that the debt, the total amount owed back to the bank, is always larger and increasing as opposed to what has been created in the first place. And that basically puts the entire global economy in a sort of position of artificial scarcity, where there's just not enough money to cover the mounting debt. There's actually three times more debt in the world than there is money. Mm-hmm. And that was a few years ago, so it's probably more than that. And basically that means that we're all on a treadmill. The economy has to grow and grow and grow in order for the banks to justify more loans to service the existing debts. It means that unless the economy grows endlessly, then there's going to be somebody somewhere is going to be going bankrupt, which again is an artificial condition placed on the situation. Because the natural world is abundant. We have all the resources we need. But we've created conditions where there's never enough money to go around. So we're all slightly meaner to each other, slightly more desperate, slightly greedier, because those kinds of behaviors have been incentivized or indeed necessitated by the system, by the way it's been designed. And so money design is just saying, okay, well, let's look at this critically. Let's open it up to discussion. Let's have a conversation about what kind of money would enable the society and the world that we all want to live in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, very, very interesting. Do you, what when you say about this treadmill and things have to just keep going, what's your opinion on what might happen? I mean, do you're obviously working in crypto. Do you feel that there will be a shift in the monetary regime? We've all moved digital. Do you think we might see some crisis in fiat currencies? Are you sort of considering that element?
Well, there are periodically crises in fiat currencies. You know, the whole boom and bust cycle is a product of this system, because you have to keep the debt crisis is literally a product of the system. You have to keep producing more debt in order to service the existing debts, and at some point the whole thing slows down. Mm. And the position we're in now is looking that way. You know, we're trying to print money. The last resort now is just like printing money to get ourselves out of the problem. And so the economy cannot slow down. It's like because of this treadmill effect. You know, try saying to somebody who is struggling to pay the mortgage on their house, you know, why don't you just calm down and work less? It's not an option. Mm. So we've placed the entire global economy in that position. And what the world desperately needs is a rest. Mm. You know, we need to stop taxing the world and the natural resources so heavily in order to keep this treadmill running. So we need somehow to slow down and move to a kind of steady state or qualitative growth rather than just any kind of growth is good growth. You know, we want certain kinds of growth, but not others. And in order to do that, we need to redesign money. So because otherwise you get hit by a tidal wave of debt. And yeah, you do get another credit crunch or you get another crisis. And that eventually leads to, you know, social instability, bankruptcy, crime, poverty, you know, and even war. So these crisis points are a chance to change and re-examine the system and put in place something new. And often it's a question of critical mass. How can we build the critical mass and critical awareness before that point so that we're ready for it when it happens?
I suppose that leads us nicely on. I mean, you mentioned a couple of times there in the last couple of minutes there, Rob, cryptocurrency, you know, and Matt mentioned it as well, we're looking to move towards a digital currency, one that's decentralized and not controlled by these banks that you spoke about earlier on. Is this what attracted you towards Beach in the first ethos?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think the answer is there isn't one answer to all of our, you know, monetary problems. Well, probably we don't need one kind of money to rule them all. We need several kinds of money, and there are going to be many answers to the problem. And Beach, I think, is one of them. And you know, obviously, the exciting thing about a token like Beach and many other cryptos is, number one, it's not produced with debt and interest. that it is free of this treadmill effect that I described before. Number two, it's decentralized. So we don't need banks in the middle to trust in order to do all these transactions. And therefore, you know, it's sort of free of their influence and control. But number three, you can design them to have very specific, unique properties, which incentivize certain kinds of behaviors that our national money is failing to do. You know, we have this big gap between what money wants and what we want. If you ask people, do you want a green revolution? They'll say, yes, of course we do. But the money won't allow them to do it because the money needs to, is tied back to debt and interest. It needs to grow exponentially. And, you know, buying a rainforest to conserve it doesn't produce returns, right? Yeah. And if you buy a rainforest and then you log it, you know, and you take out a loan to do so, then you can pay the interest on the loan. So it's very, you know, the debt and interest makes it very difficult to conserve the rainforest metaphorically, and very easy, or incentivizes people who'll come along and extract more wealth from it to pay the interest. Well, with beach, you can do something else. You know, with beach, we're incentivizing people to clean up the beaches, for example, or grow seaweed or restore the corals. And because of the way that the currency is designed, we can build that into the way it works so that we create the conditions for the planet we want to live on.
Yeah, so I mean obviously I'm trying to stay in the stock box or market using side of things today. Obviously I'm involved with beach, so I don't want to jump onto the beach side at the moment, but yeah, I mean, so I do good with the environment. It's almost like the byproduct of the financial systems that we are creating within the token. I mean, I think it may be quite good to, you know, explain sort of tokenomics, because there's probably a lot of potential investors in DeFi might not understand what tokenomics are in the model.
Yeah, sure. So, we have built into the tokenomics a 15% whenever you buy or sell. And that 15% we do various things with. Is a true burn. So that means that the currency literally ceases to exist. We destroy the 2% of the transaction when you buy or sell. And because the supply is finite of beach, that means that over time, the price should go up as the supply gets less and less. 3% we distribute to holders as reflections. So if you hold beach, when anyone buys or sells, you will accrue more beach. You'll get a slice of that 3% pro rata, depending on how much of the total pie you hold. So that makes beach very attractive currency to hold onto. Reflections you get, and those reflections are compounded. And of course, it's deflationary, so it should go up in value. So it's a very good investment from that point of view. But we also, as we've discussed, we 2% is goes towards ocean conservation. So we have cleaner towards that involves things like litter picks and beach cleaned. And then 1% goes towards blue carbon projects like seaweed farming, like mangrove restoration, that kind of thing. And then that leaves 8% as a boost fund. Which basically allows us to, you know, allows us to keep lights on, essentially, to keep the whole thing running and do all the work that needs to be done in the background. But it also allows us to stabilize the price in fluctuating market conditions. It's composed of Ethereum and DAI stablecoin and BNB as well. Yes, if there's a sort of downturn, then we're sort of we have a degree of kind of hedge to stabilize the price of the currency.
Yeah, I couldn't explain that any better, Rob. I mean, as much as I'm involved, we stumble across the tokenomics. But no, it's certainly a lot more interesting than money. So it is, and there's the opportunities out there. And obviously, it may be beneficial to explain. You know, it doesn't end with beach cleans or mangrove plant or a seaweed growing. There's obviously some utilities and bigger pictures, the beach collective. Maybe you could give a high level overview of that as well, because that's the kind of, not the end game, but it's to be.
Yeah, and the cool thing that I like about it is that it's modular. in the sense that, you know, if we were to just leave Peak as it's working now, with people investing, you know, essentially mostly speculating, we'd still be taking the transaction tax and we could still fund ocean conservation. And that kind of does tick over on itself. That works fine. But really, the more powerful thing is adoption at scale, because then, and you know, then you're taking far more, you know, transaction taxes, and you can do far more ocean conservation. You know, in the end, we don't want to just be something that people invest and speculate in. We want to be used, because then you have this effect on people's values. Like I said, money's a social design which designs the social. So the implication there is that, you know, when you design money in a different way, you create a different society, and you actually. And that's what we're trying to do with the Beach Collective. It's a four-part sort of hybrid investment and utility platform. So there will be the Beach Shop. It will be an online marketplace for ethical brands and products. You could list this co-living space on there, but you could also list a dog lead made from fishing nets, or even just I don't know, some, you know, you could sell food and vegetables on there, whatever you want. It's an online shop. Gig, which is a freelancer portal for people like me. So these people who, Polish couple I told you about who have an animation studio, they can list their services on there and they charge mm-hmm. each, and they can, anyone in the world can pay them to do some animation for them. We're going to have a payment app as well, Beach Pay. So the three of us go out for dinner. We can split the bill. I can send you guys some beach on the app. And then finally, we're going to have Clean to Earn, which is basically the next evolution of all the sort of worldwide partners that we have doing ocean conservation. But it'll just be decentralized. So imagine, if you will, a kind of Pokemon Go, but for picking up litter instead of finding Pokemon. So, you know, it could be a sort of virtual reality enabled sort of world where I can post, I can tag like litter on the beach, for example. So I can say, you know, there's some litter here on the beach, and I can take a photo of me picking it up and cleaning it. And somebody can come along later with their phone, see me picking up the litter through their phone and swipe me some beach. Or it could work that, I don't know, Billabong sponsor a beach in Crete, for example, and their little logo is floating over the beach. And there's a little bounty of beach token, and anybody who comes along and cleans the beach can release the bounty. So that I think will be exceptionally powerful. And the more that we can kind of build out all those four things, the more they'll mutually support each other, because people are picking up bits of their earning beach. Okay, now I need somewhere to spend it. Or, you know, a freelancer is selling their services, they're earning money. Okay, but then they want to, you know, use it to split dinner with their friends. So they'll all kind of mutually reinforce each other.
Yeah, and of course, as you said, it's scalable as well. So obviously, I mean, we had a podcast the other day Endorse and Coincilium, who are in the sort of play-to-earn metaverse NFT space. I mean, that's all stuff we can bolt on in due course as well. And we've obviously had discussions about, you know, all that. And so it's a whole ecosystem, a whole world almost, that we can pay for everything with the beach, which would certainly float my boat and yours, Mark, because you've got beach tokens as well.
I do have beach tokens, yeah, but this whole kind of ecosystem that you were building, I didn't really get the picture of that until, Rob, you've just explained that there. And yeah, I was going to ask you how do you reward people, but you've given an example there of, yeah, if a company was to sponsor a beach clean, for example, well, you know, there's your reward there, isn't there? I think you kind of answered that, but it's much more than just a crypto token, isn't it?
Definitely. Well, put it this way, Mark, next time you come across to Scotland, and the coffee shop should hopefully be set up to accept beach, and you can, I'll probably end up paying for it in beach tokens, but I can
buy them. So that's with Beach Pay then?
So that would be Beach Pay, yeah. So I would accept beach tokens in the coffee shop as payment for coffee, sandwich, whatever. I mean, there's not going to be like people queuing up to pay in beach because it's, you know, it's early days yet. But I mean, obviously you've got them, I've got them, you know, your friends and family have got them. So yeah, it wouldn't take long for the word to get out. And that's just one example. So I've quite happily said I'll be one of the first guinea pigs to try out the system. But definitely floats my boat, and I'm sure, I mean, people are voting with their feet nowadays when they go shopping anyway, and, you know, they're buying more ethical and, you know, buying recycled. In fact, my wife the other day, in fact, yesterday, she went and bought a pair of jeans that was made for recycled plastic bottles, I think. So people are now starting to be a bit more choosy of what they're buying, where they're buying it from.
That's very true. Do you think, either of you, that we will have a shift in the way then, as we started the podcast, redesigning money, a shift in the way we do deal with money, and there will still be government-issued currencies for sure, whether it's digital, it probably will be. But do you think there will be other currencies that are sort of running alongside, let's say, I don't know, the mainstream ones, that, as you say, people can then decide to choose to use X currency because it does X good things? I mean, so do you completely see a transformation in the monetary system?
I think these things can work side by side. I think, you know, like I said before, I think that what is not a good idea is one kind of money, because really money is supposed to do an awful lot of different jobs, you know. It's useful as a store of value. It's useful as a means of exchange. But it can also be used, depending on how you design it, like each. So, I was just going to give you a couple more examples of different ideas of sort of alternative currencies that have been proposed in the past, just to give you an idea of the full range of what's possible. There are things called like a local exchange trading systems. And, you know, some of these are huge. There's one in Switzerland called the Weir, which does billions of euros worth of trade every year. But essentially, it's like a barter ring. So me, Mark, Kenny, and, you know, five other people all start on zero. If I go to Mark's shop and buy something, I go to minus 10 and he goes to plus 10, and he could spend his plus 10 with Kenny. And it's just an accounting system, right? So it allows you basically to do lots of transactions without, you know, you have liquidity in the middle and trust, but you don't need any national currency to do that. Other systems, for example, there's time banks where you volunteer an hour of time in your local community and you get paid in an hour, basically, and you can then spend that hour at the local cinema or hairdresser or whatever. There was one in Brussels where if you recycle, you get paid in a certain credit and you can use those credits on the bus. So there's so many different kind of ideas and designs of money. And I think ideally we want to move to a future where there's a hybrid system where there's different money, different kinds of money doing different functions. And Beach, I think, needs to be part of that picture. But the more these things catch on, the more they erode the power of national currency, the kind of monopoly they have. And then, you know, they force a reaction, I think. It'd be interesting to see what that reaction is exactly.
Mm. Yeah, if it's regulation, for example.
Yeah, probably. But we'll see. I mean, you know, also, can you regulate them? I mean, the cat's out of the bag. I don't know how much regulation you can do. The whole point is that it can be non-traceable, right? So it'll be interesting to see how they even think about that.
Mm. Yeah, and to be honest, this was nowhere near mass adoption yet of cryptocurrency. It's still in the early days. It's almost like the first year of the internet. I think we've discussed this a few times, Mark. You know, people are still a bit kind of wary of it, and especially in my sort of generation. You know, I'm late 40s. It's, you know, we're not your typical crypto investor. You know, it's a guy straight out of uni or the guys at your age. So, yeah, there's still a great fear of the unknown. And listen, some of it is the wild west out there, but I'm sure over time it'll be survival of the fittest and the ones that are fit for purpose rather than the fittest. And once mass adoption takes off, you'll be doing it without even knowing it. So you will. I mean, everything will be done through your phone. I mean, you can buy cars now with cryptocurrency. You know, what's next? Buy a house with cryptocurrency. I mean, you might laugh at it, but it might be mainstream in 10 years. You know, the possibilities are endless.
Mm. There's definitely a sort of ease of use barrier, you know. You know, at the moment, there are some like technical fiddly bits to buying and selling crypto, particularly, you know, smaller tokens. But that'll go, you know, as you say, sooner or later, it'll be as easy as a swipe on your phone or a tap of a button. And then as soon as it's easy, then that's then, you know, then suddenly there's no barrier.
Actually make money out of this rather than stifling it. I'm sure they'll jump on the horse as well, and we'll all be sailing in the same ship. But no, but it'll be interesting to see where we are in 5 or 10 years' time. It's definitely it's an interesting world we live in just now. And I must admit, I took the plunge probably about 13, 14 months ago, and obviously with my involvement through Beach, you know, I'm pretty cool on in the crypto. So I'm a great believer, and I'd like to think I'm an early adopter. So in maybe 20, 30 years, I can tell the grand lines. Yeah, I was one of the first guys I wanted to buy, you know, cryptocurrency, etc. But there we go. Sorry, Rob.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, the first time I heard about Bitcoin is because people, it was like friends at uni were buying weed on the dark net. You know, like, what was that website? There was some website called the Silk Road. Mm. And you could basically just like, but get drugs delivered to your door, but you needed, you know, Bitcoin. And so people were basically spending what today is worth like hundreds of thousands of pounds, like for like a bag of weed for like half a Bitcoin or something. It's hilarious. But I invested in like 2015, just because I saw the potential of decentralized money. I was like, this is interesting. It's going to shake up the system. I know our current money is broken. Like, I'll get in. So I got in. I spent like $3,000 in 2015, and I sold in the last spike, you know, in 2017. But you know, I wish I'd held on to it. I mean, you can always think like that, can't you?
Yeah, you can always think, look back at what you could have had, but it's not always the best thing to do. How does Beach then make the sort of the leap? You think what where's the focus now in what you're developing, and how do you think it makes that kind of leap to being more easy for people to buy and sell and you know be the because I guess you're going for that kind of mainstream, you know, recognition of Beach as well, are you?
Yeah, well, Jenny's probably better placed to speak to this than I am. But yeah, essentially, you know, the next iteration will be the Beach Collective, Beach Shop, Beach Gig. And then shortly after that, a sort of fiat on and off ramp. Yeah. So the idea is that you can just whack in your card details into the Beach Collective and buy Beach that way. And, you know, your purse gets topped up and then you can spend it.
I think the first entry for many people into crypto will be buying NFTs in some shape or form. As you said, Rob, the fiat on off ramp will certainly enable people to do that seamlessly. So I mean, that's one of the projects we're looking at aligned with the Kelp investment, a series of NFTs to fund these Kelp investments, and we are confident that will attract investors that obviously would probably have been wary of buying crypto. But key to that, as Rob says, is the fiat, well, definitely the fiat on ramp anyway. But we're not alone in that particular problem. You know, many tokens have this issue at the moment. But there's all sorts of companies popping up to make it easier and et cetera. So hopefully in a couple of years it'll just be like, listen, it was a bit like when you had your debit card and contactless come out. Everybody was a bit, oh, I don't know, this is a bit dangerous. And now, you know, I curse and swear, and I've got to insert my card into the machine, you know, because you're that used to it and you've just accepted it as a norm, you know. And you see people, I mean, there was somebody the other day, they came to the coffee shop. Obviously, people pay with a phone and they pay with a watch, you know, Apple Pay, whatever, but somebody paid with a ring, which was really bizarre. And I meant to ask them, you know, what the hell is that? But it went through. So
I mean, how do you get more micro than that? What do you mean, people just like farting and paying by their unique fart signature or something? I mean, it's like, there's no, where else can it go? iScan or something? I don't know.
Well, you're getting vein technology recognition as well now. I think it's a company called FingoPay. And regardless of whether your hand's wet or dirty, you know, you just place your finger on this pad and it, everybody's got like a unique vein structure, whatever, under your finger, something else.
Christ, that's scary, isn't it?
Yeah, there's endless opportunities. And all this can be tied in cryptocurrency as well. So We can talk. I wasn't this, but we've already been chatting 45 minutes, so I think we'll maybe save that for another day, Robin. We'll get you back on, hopefully, when we've got some of these utilities up and running, and we can put some more meat in the bones.
Yeah, I'd love that. Yeah, thanks very much for having me, Mark and Kenny. It's been really enjoyable.
You know, it's been very good to talk to you, and yeah, I agree with Kenny. We should talk to you again. You know, as Beach progresses, but also just general on crypto space and, you know, what's going on and your thoughts on where we are in the cycle. If it's still moving in cycles, it would be interesting to sort of muse on that as well. But thank you very much for your time today, just telling us there more about Mark Beach and, of course, redesigning money. Yeah, I think you'll like that guy Lawrence that I follow. He's all about that and making money efficient. And yeah, trying to fix the world through the money design. So yeah, it's been really good to talk. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, guys. Have a nice day.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.